Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined once again by our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Good morning.
And this week, we'll also be hearing from Dakota Johnson, Tahar Rahim, and S.J. Clarkson about Madam Web. We'll be reviewing that film, as well as biopic Bob Marley, One Love, The Taste of Things, starring Juliette Binoche, and Promised Land, which reunites Mads Mikkelsen with the director of A Royal Affair. We'll also be mentioning a few re-releases you can find in the cinema this week. But before we get onto those, what have you been up to this week, Jamie? Have you watched anything outside of these films we're going to be discussing?
I have indeed, Matt. We've been on deadline this week, so it's been a bit brutal, but you know I always find time. So basically, I've hoovered down the whole of Mr. and Mrs. Smith over the course of like 3 or 4 days. It's only 8 episodes. So pleasantly surprised by it. Like the original film with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie is kind of decent, sort of slightly trashy action movie. It's okay, and I expected more of the same, but they've completely reinvented it. But it's the same basic concept of a husband and wife sort of super agents, but they do it with a very different tone. It's a lot more measured, and it kind of tracks the arc of a relationship that they're throwing together at the start, and they get to know each other and then begin to fall in love. And then, you know, as things go on, work gets in the way and little niggles start, and then they begin to fracture. And it's just done in a really intelligent, measured way. When the action does come, it's really good. The action beats are great. The pacing's fantastic. Really, really funny. The humour surprised me so much. It's got loads of low-key, dry, kind of throwaway humour that is so well done. And the cast is absolutely fantastic. The chemistry, it's Donald Glover and Maya Erskine, and they're so good together. And so I was massively surprised, really, but I sort of put it on as a bit of light entertainment, thinking this would get me through the week. But I've had a whale of a time with it.
Awesome. I really, really do want to watch that. I will try and get around to it. Like, as you mentioned, we've been on a particularly delirious deadline. We've literally just finished an issue and bundled into this podcast, so if me and Jamie sound a bit delirious, that'll be why. So I haven't really been able to watch much. I've got that really annoying thing to say where I watched something yesterday, but it's completely embargoed. I can't even sort of say that I've seen the film. And then tonight I'm going to the premiere of Dune Part 2. Ooh. So that's obviously very exciting, but obviously, as of right now, I've got nothing to say about it because I haven't seen it.
Just quickly, the other thing I've done, because I've managed to squeeze in a few Tony Scott films as well.
Oh, nice.
I'm doing a kind of rewatch of all of Tony Scott. So I've been doing all of his later films because I know his earlier work, Inside Out, I've seen them many times. But I've doing some of the later ones, you know, like Domino and stuff like that, where maybe he began to fade a little bit. But I've had a great time. Not with Domino. I don't like Domino, but I've enjoyed the others, Spy Games, Deja Vu, stuff like that.
So now we got that out of the way, let's move on to this week's new releases, and starting with the first big comic book movie of the year.
Hey, come on, get your stuff. Let's go. Let's try that again.
So this is Madam Web, which is Sony's latest Marvel movie. So it's not a kind of in the MCU, it's in the Sony side of things. And this one, again, as we get with comic movies, it's a more obscure character. It's Cassandra Cassie Webb, who's played by Dakota Johnson. And she doesn't have traditional superhero powers. She's kind of gifted with these sort of premonition powers where she can sort of see a little bit into the future. So it's quite a different type of superhero movie. So before we get into actually reviewing the film, Amy West recently spoke to stars Dakota Johnson and Tahar Rahim and director S.J. Clarkson. You can hear their chat now.
A week ago, I spent my life racing against time.
I'm going to help you out today, okay?
Trying to save people who were running out of it.
Jesse!
Until one moment changed everything.
Come on!
Welcome back to the land that we're living.
I don't understand what's happening. I've been having visions. I knew he was gonna die. I think I'm seeing the future.
I just want to say I see a lot of superhero films and it's refreshing to see one that actually has stakes and blood, and I didn't realize I'd been missing that so much.
I didn't realize that. Is there not, there's not blood in other superhero movies?
I mean, not a lot.
I guess
kind
not
of
really,
get
huh?
Bashed around the head and thrown about, but there's not really much.
Right. Yeah.
I think it's fair to say this is a different kind of project for you. What kind of drew you to this one and what were you most excited about to explore?
I hadn't ever thought that I would be like in a superhero world. But then when this script came along, I loved the idea of a superhero being a young woman whose mind was extremely powerful. And I liked the dynamic between her and these three young women and how they, you know, like genuinely protect and support and care for each other. And it just seemed different to me. And it was way more grounded and real and gritty. And I just thought it was an interesting way to experience that world.
I was going to ask, was Cassie kind of fleshed out when you got the script, or were you able to sort of like tweak her personality?
It was important to me to add some humor and some levity and some just some more complexities to her, which SJ was super helpful with, and, you know, bring more complications to her human being.
Yeah, she feels like a real person that I would know. She's kind of awkward and she takes the piss out of her friends and stuff yeah. like that. I was going to ask as well how her job as a paramedic, like what that says about her as a person, because it's kind of interesting because she's a bit kind of standoffish. She's a bit like on the outside of everyone. She doesn't really want to get like stuck in with parties and things like that, but she obviously feels a great responsibility to, you know, save people. So mm-hmm. what does that kind of say about her and how she goes into being a superhero?
I think that Cassie is a paramedic because she has this like unending, like this insatiable quest to save other people because she wasn't able to save her mother. I think that's at the root of it for her. So it's this sort of this journey that she'll be on forever to kind of make up for this huge loss in her life.
And what was it kind of like getting stuck in with the action part of it and the green screen side of it? Was that a challenge or something that you enjoyed?
It was so fun. I mean, it's so fun to have an added challenge of physicality, and I loved it so much. And working on a blue screen was fun. It's weird at first to get used to. I hadn't really done work like that. But once you like just start to use your imagination, it was really fun.
What was it like working with SJ Clarkson as a director?
She's so wonderful. She's an incredible director. She is so professional. She's so experienced. And she's, you know, in a movie that has a lot of flashbacks and visions of the future and present moments, when you're shooting out of sequence, it can be very, very confusing. And she was just such a wonderful guide. And I felt like I was in really safe hands.
I want to ask as well, what was it like suiting up? Because I feel like you kind of get the best of both worlds because you get a taste of it, but you didn't have to spend weeks on end on set in spandex, basically.
Right. Yeah, that was very cool. I mean, having a superhero suit made for my body was like, you dream of those kinds of things. It was really fun. And also her super suit is unlike any other hero's suit I've ever seen. It's like really chic. It has flared legs. So it's bell bottoms.
And a cool mask as well.
Mm-hmm.
Miss the eye mask things.
Yeah.
So I wanted to just ask what it was like working with the girls, basically.
They were great. They are wonderful people and so professional and fun to have three, you know, young people on set who really got along very well. It brings a really fun energy and they were just great.
At the end of this, I felt like I really kind of wanted to see more. I wanted to find out, you know, how the girls got their powers and what Cassandra was going to do, you know, after what happens to her and how she deals with that going forward. Has there been any talks of a sequel? And if they were to make one, what would you be most excited about?
I don't know. I mean, if they want me to come back, then I definitely will. I have no idea what's in store.
The movie kind of plays with Madame Webb's sort of origins and history. How did you arrive at the story that you're telling here?
Well, I was very lucky that it sort of came as a script sort of already when I got it. And so it was about me taking that and helping shape her and bring her more to life. So, you know, what I was very excited by was the fact that this was an unusual superpower. It's not one that probably most people would have on their top 5, maybe not even the top 10. I'd like to see the future. But I just thought that was a really interesting concept. And, you know, because it was so psychological, that it could be a thriller, a psychological thriller, more cerebral and therefore more grounded. And I found that really interesting and exciting to explore that in the cinematic world.
Yeah. Did you have a look at the comics, or were you kind of more influenced by, you know, thrillers, existing thrillers?
I think both. I mean, the comic books are, you know, they are the Bible of all Marvel, really. And, you know, so to go back to those and have that and really sort of see who her character is and who it becomes is really interesting, because it gave us clairvoyance. We see where she becomes. Yes. So how do we find a way to get there? So that was the gift, really. It was almost the clairvoyance of the comics enabled us to realize her origin.
I know a lot of people were sort of saying it's a bit Final Destination-y when they saw the trailer, which I was intrigued by as a fan of those series.
It was exciting to be able to have those sort of thriller slash horror moments in it, because if you do see really scary things in the future, it's like a nightmare in a way, and you wake up from them, or, you know, if they're hitting you in the most random moments, like on a train or when you're sort of a paramedic trying to save somebody's life and these things come hurtling at you, you know, it's like, how would you deal with that and how would you react to it? And also when everybody else around you is looking at you thinking you're going crazy.
Those scenes felt quite disorientating, and it's interesting because it fits into the tone of the film. This isn't your sort of first Marvel rodeo. What did you learn on Jessica Jones that you kind of brought forward to this?
Well, Jessica Jones really was my first introduction to comics, really. And I just, again, but it came from the character, which it did with Cassie. It came completely from the character. And you know, obviously Jessica was a superhero. She had strength, you know, and she could jump really high, and Madame Web didn't have that. So it sort of made it even more challenging, because you had such a narrow lane with which to go in. But then therefore I thought, well, these cinematic opportunities are huge, because how can I show this psychologically? And Jessica as well had PTSD, so I'd already done some playing with the mind, you know, so obviously I wanted to make it different. You can't do it the same. We couldn't shoot it in the same way. So I had to come up with a technique of clairvoyance and, you know, figure out how to find a way in and out of that, which became quite a rudimentary use of a diopter in front of the camera, which probably I shouldn't give away because that's a spoiler. But these wonderful actors allowed me to run around while they're in the middle of intense scenes. Especially the diner, which is one of our favourite scenes.
Yeah, I love the diner scene. Tahar, I was going to say, this is a kind of different movie than you've done before. What really drew you to the project?
I mean, the whole universe, the Marvel universe, the fact of playing a superhero. I mean, when I'm back to France or whatever, you it's not our mythology, so you don't get those type of offers quite often. And when it happens in this industry, you're interested, happy, excited. But then you have to read the script, and the script was good. The story was great, the character as well, and meet the director, with whom I had a beautiful relationship and great conversations. And I needed those three elements to be here, and everything was there. So all I had to do now was to work and jump in, and I loved it.
It's interesting you say jumping, because I was going to say, how was it jumping into the kind of action side of it? How much of it did you get to do?
I did as much as I could. And
he did a lot. He's been modest. Yeah. He did a lot. He was in those wires. He was flung against the wall. He did some, you know, leaping around. You definitely did
it's
a lot.
It's true. Barefoot.
You did. Barefoot. Yeah.
In a suit. Like, you were rocking the suit, but the feet were free.
Exactly.
This film kind of rephrases the iconic line of with great power comes great responsibility. Where did that sort of idea come from?
You know, we tried to be just honourable of the comics and where she came from in a way, you know. And I think that, you know, every hero has a moment where their sort of mentor says to them a line which inspires them on the way. And this felt like, you know, a nod to where she was from, and also made it hers.
And SJ, I wanted to ask you about the music, because 12-year-old me never thought she'd hear a Mystique song in a superhero film. I absolutely loved it. How did you pick those songs? Did you just kind of go back to 2003 and look at what came out, or?
Toxic was in the original script. So, you know, that sort of set the foundations for where we were going to go. And Mystique was actually a suggestion by Claire Parker, who's one of our writers and exec producers. So she sort of suggested that, and it worked really well. But I, you know, it's so fun to get some of that music back in it, right? You know, for me, apparently I'm vintage now that I remember the noughties, but, you know, that was my time.
So that was Dakota Johnson, Tahar Rahim and SJ Clarkson talking about Madame Web. And now, Jamie, it's time for us to talk about this film. We didn't go to any press screenings of this because they didn't put any press screenings on. So this is why the podcast is running slightly late. We had to go to the cinema when it came out and watch it. And again, you don't need premonition powers to know that's not always a great sign when there's not screenings for press for a film. But always going with an open mind. And again, just to kind of briefly set up this story, as I mentioned, a slightly obscure character from the comics, so not someone I was particularly familiar with before seeing the film, but we know we're broadly speaking in the Spider-Man world. So we begin with a prologue in 1973 in the Peruvian Amazon, where our kind of our lead character's mum is researching these powerful spiders, and she has a run-in with Tahar Rahim's character, Ezekiel Sims. And then we jump forward 30 years. So we're still only in 2003 by this point. So it's kind of got this quote unquote retro setting, if you will. And by this point, Cassie has grown up. Her mum was pregnant when she died, but Cassie survived and she's now living as a paramedic in Manhattan. Early on in the film, she discovers these kind of clairvoyant psychic abilities, which allow her to sort of briefly see the future. And this kind of puts her on a sort of collision course with these three young women, Sydney Sweeney's Julia Cornwall, Celeste O'Connor's Mattie Franklin, and Isabel Merced's Anya Corazon. And then they're basically being tracked by Tahar Rahim's character, Ezekiel, who's having kind of visions of his own relating to these three young women. Following on from that prologue, he's been using the powers of these spiders to turn himself into this kind of dark Spider-Man type character. Yeah, so it's a bit of a mystery as to why these women and Ezekiel are connected and how he's going after them. But Cassie is using her skills to kind of try and stay one step ahead of his plans. And then we kind of get into the mystery from there. I mean, by the time you hear this, you've probably seen some fairly scathing reviews. Total Film's own review is a 1-star, which is quite rare for this sort of scale of film. I mean, it's quite rare we dish out ones, really. Jamie, did you like the film?
No, I didn't, Matt. I didn't. In the 1-star camp as well, I'd maybe squeeze it a 2 if I was in a really generous mood. I mean, I don't think it's particularly much worse than the last few comic book movies we've seen. I think we're on a real dip with like Shazam 2 and Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, Morbius, stuff like that. You know, I don't think that this is much, much worse than those. So if you got something out of them, then maybe you win out of this. But to use some terrible puns, it's a real tangled web of a film and everyone has visions, but it's hard from visionary filmmaking. It just felt to me messy and like almost like a pilot for a kind of TV show. And, you know, it just didn't hang together. And I know that they did quite a few reshoots and they sort of re-sculpted it. It's very weird that, like you said, it's in the Sony Pictures universe of Marvel characters, but it's not. They sort of stripped that away from it when they did reshoots and sort of repositioned it. They wanted to make it a sort of thriller, and it's like they kind of took all of those references out. But you see these spider characters, various people crawling on ceilings and walls, but they never really refer to Spider-Man. And like Adam Scott plays a version of Ben Parker in this. He's another paramedic who works with Cassandra Webb. It feels like this real sort of hodgepodge. And my problem with it was that it's very contained. It's smaller than a lot of these superhero movies are, which is no bad thing, because I'm kind of fed up with saving the world, that everything is like intergalactic and massive. So it's smaller. But if you're going to go smaller and have a more sort of, you know, character TV vibe, then you have to have good characters. You have to have witty dialogue. It's got to be more to invest in a way. And the characters just feel so flat. The kind of three women you referred to, who, like Sydney Sweeney, is a tremendous actor. We love her from stuff like Reality and White Lotus, but she's just got a really bland role in this. It's not Sydney Sweeney who we know. She's very sort of demure in it and sort of straight and boring. The other women in it, you know, Isabella Merced and Celeste O'Connor, they're not given much to play with. And when you're hanging out with these three characters, it's not a particularly good time. It's just something feels off with it. You know, it doesn't hang together.
I'm very much on the same page as you in that, like, I went into this with an open mind because I have really liked Dakota Johnson and a lot of stuff in the past. I like Sydney Sweeney, Tahar Rahim. Like, I mean, again, going back to like A Prophet, he's just so good in that, like, you know, once you've seen that, you're kind of willing to watch him in anything, really. You mentioned Adam Scott. I thought he was one of the few sort of saving graces of the film, even though his character doesn't really add much to it. He brought a sort of likability to it, I thought. And was one of the few characters I actually felt sort of drawn towards and drawn to kind of knowing a bit more about. Whereas Dakota Johnson, she seemed like she was uninterested throughout. Like all her line deliveries were just a bit flat. You don't get that famous line from the trailer that became a crazy meme where it was, he was with my mum when she died while she was researching spiders in the Amazon or it was something like that. But that line, yeah. I don't know if it was anything to do with the trailer reaction, but that line isn't in the actual film. Sorry to report. But just so many of other of her line deliveries are flat. There's this weird thing where they just get her to speak aloud quite often, like she speaks to a cat quite often just to kind of spell out what she's feeling. But it just feels so, so poorly done throughout. These three young characters she runs into, like you say, they don't really have much character individually to speak of. We get these kind of glimpses of these superhero characters they're going to become, but it's just such a brief glimpse. And I thought, after showing those glimpses in the trailer, you just expect a bit more of that. Like I love an origin story, you know, that builds up to a superhero kind of getting their suit and taking their sort of superhero form. But this, it just, there was just so little of that it just didn't deliver on that front. Again, like you say, maybe gave it that kind of TV pilot kind of quality. And there were just quite a lot throughout that just made it feel a bit cheap. Like one of the things being, there was some of the most blatant product placement I've seen in a while in a film. It just added to this feeling of like just a poor product overall, in that it felt that cheapened it. Some of the sort of visual effects cheapened it, the sort of references to Spider-Man, but not kind of cheapened it. The way it was shot, I thought, like in terms of the camera movements, in a really ugly way. I don't know if it's just because I was sitting relatively far forward at the cinema. It was sort of making my head hurt a bit the way it was kind of swishing around and never was sort of satisfyingly staged. I didn't think where, you know, you actually got to see some decent action choreography or anything. It just felt like it was just whooshing around. And just even things like, and this goes into that thing you were saying about how it feels a bit chopped up, you know. Like at one point, Cassie just goes off to research her mum's past and she just heads off to Peru. And it's just like, things just jump around like that, like with no real kind of sense of time. And then there's a moment sort of midway where Cassie kind of leaves these three young girls like in this kind of woods where they've kind of taken a bit of refuge. And then she's just like, oh, just hang out here. I'll be back in a few hours. It's just things like that just felt weird. Like they just hadn't satisfyingly worked out how this was going to work.
When she goes off back to Peru, to the Amazon jungle, to kind of learn about her mum and where her powers came from and all stuff like that as well. There's a big scene that takes place in a cave, like a really important scene. She goes into his cave and it just feels so fake. It's like this big sort of polystyrene studio set cave, which again gave it that pilot feel. But yeah, I mean, some of the things you said, the product placement, I mean, if I'm going to be really, really generous, there's a big action scene that takes place on the Pepsi Cola sign, like in Queens, which I'm going to be generous because it reminded me of the kind of finale of Highlander with the Silver Cup sign. So I had a sort of certain fondness for that. I don't know if it was a deliberate nod, but then they followed that scene by like one of the characters was just chilling out drinking Pepsi Cola. And it's just like, oh my God. Yeah, it's not great. And you mentioned the flash forwards. There's a couple of brief flash forwards to the women sort of in their spider costumes because they're going to become spider women. But those flashes, one, they're so brief. And two, like the CGI and the costumes are awful. And like, there's not a lot of CGI in this film compared to other superhero films, which again is quite a good thing because I think they overplay it in a lot of films and they can feel a bit plastic, but what there is really bad. And unfortunately, based on the reviews to this and the fact I'm sure the public won't take to it either, I don't think we're ever going to see those characters as spider women in the future because I just can't see a follow-up coming.
I'd be extremely surprised if we ever see anything from this film again, which is a shame obviously because there is a lot of potential there, but it's just really, really squandered here. Like it's that thing again, you know, you never know what happens along the way and if things have been chopped and changed, but it's hard to know even what potential these like talented people sort of saw in it to begin with. It was like, it was that bad for me. And even Tahar Rahim, who again, like I say, someone who I've really enjoyed in the past, A Prophet is like a classic. He's amazing in that. But I just thought he had no kind of charisma here. Often just had this feeling that he was kind of dubbed over almost, like had that kind of feeling a few times. Again, just clunky line readings. It was always sort of hard to tell what his character was really up to. there's this character played by Zosia Mamet, you know, from Girls, who's kind of his like assistant who mans the kind of screens of his sort of little tech setup that he's got. And again, there was some stuff that I was almost howling at laughing, where he's had these visions of these three young women. So he wants to sort of find them, basically, because he has these visions that they're going to end up bringing about his downfall. So he's seeking them out. But then they kind of filter them into this like photo fit thing in the computer. And they're like, oh, is this what they look like? And they've just got these perfect photos of these three people. And then they start using that with like, you know, to scan all the security camera footage from the city. But it's done in that kind of, you know, zoom enhanced kind of way. But it's just so clumsily and badly that they clearly just needed a way to help him kind of come into contact with them. But they just could have found something better than that. It was just, that's what I mean. It just felt comically bad at times. Like
having spider powers and everything else obviously isn't enough, that you need someone also on the monitors with this unbelievable newfangled tech that can literally scan the entire city and find people just like that, you know, zoom in on people going by in cars and stuff. It's all a bit ridiculous. And I think, not great. Avoid.
Yeah. And besides the Ben Parker factor, which I guess they need to have him as the appropriate age, and there's a couple of other hints that, you know, what's going on. I just didn't really understand why it was set in 2003, besides having a few like catchy songs on the soundtrack. There's just no real reason for it to be set at that time. I didn't think there's this odd thing that obviously Ezekiel is this kind of dark Spider-Man type character. So it's odd that there's a Spider-Man that exists in this world who looks quite a lot like Spider-Man, but in this world and timeline, Peter Parker hasn't even been born yet, you know.
Maybe there was a reason before they chopped and changed it and repositioned it all. Yeah, I mean, talking of 2003, I mean, there's a blast of Britney Spears' Toxic on the soundtrack at one point, which was one of a few scenes I vaguely enjoyed set in a diner. But the weird thing with that is they're just going through, they're walking, like you said, the girls are left in a forest in the wood, and they just walk through the wood and they just come out by this diner, which seems to be, I mean, it's on a road, but it seems to be in the middle of nowhere. And it's this perfect gleaming diner that again just looks like the production have built it from scratch, you know, and it's on a soundstage. It's just mad, absolutely mad.
I'm sorry to say, it genuinely doesn't bring me any pleasure, like I say, because I go into every film hoping to like it, especially when it's like, you know, people I like a lot, and I'm always up for a good comic book movie as well. But this was just a true dud for me.
I was on the 1-2 border because there's a couple of little things I like. And like you said, Ben Parker, played by Adam Scott, is the real high point of the film. So I'm always looking for positives. I don't want to be too down on films. You know, I love films, have a passion for them. I'd like to give it two, but after this talk with you, Matt, I've definitely talked myself into the one camp. It's definitely a one.
Okay. If you actually, after all that, if you did still want to sort of witness it for yourself, Madam Web is in cinemas now. It opened on Valentine's Day, so it's already out. We've seen it in public screening. So yeah, you can check it out if you so wish. And on to the next film this week. We're into musical biopic territory with this.
Reggae is the people music.
You know, you're a superstar.
I am a superstar.
You can't separate the music and the message.
You see, reggae music come to unify the people.
Not everyone likes what you're saying. For your own safety, you need to stop.
That is Bob Marley, One Love, the new biopic of Bob Marley, of course. And it's directed by Reinaldo Marcus Green, who did King Richard, directed Will Smith to his Oscar there. Yeah, we're very much in a, I suppose, particularly since Bohemian Rhapsody proved to be such an enormous hit. We've had a lot of musical biopics like Rocket Man, Back to Black, the Amy Winehouse one coming up. There's a Michael Jackson one coming up as well. So very much, obviously, they're trying to make this a thing, and obviously they can really catch fire and take off when you've got this great music, and obviously you've got kind of like a ready-made icon there to dive into. Often as well, it gives people a chance to get a really great performance. Obviously, Rami Malek won every award going for Bohemian Rhapsody. Not that I didn't particularly like that film, but I can see why people took to that performance. People like those impersonations of people they know well, and, you know, like to see these icons reborn on screen. This is basically Bob Marley getting that treatment. This one focuses largely on a very specific part of Bob Marley's life. We begin with these quite clumsy title cards, really, that try and set up the sort of political circumstances he's living in. We start early on with an assassination attempt on his life as well. And from there, we see him kind of go to London, put together the Exodus album, do this world tour, you know, see his stardom really rise and sort of leading towards one of the great and sort of politically resonant concerts of his career. There's sort of a lot going on, but at the same time, it's quite tightly focused on a particular time period. And we do jump back in time to see some bits from his childhood and things like that. But I have to say, again, I wasn't a fan of this film. It's been a slightly disappointing week so far for the new releases. Again, it's another film that's already out, so you may have already seen this already by the time you hear this. But I had several big problems with this. In part, it was that I didn't know a huge amount about this world and the political landscape. I saw the 2012 documentary Marley by Kevin MacDonald. I saw that at the time. I remember really liking it. It's much more in depth than what you get here. But here I was kind of, you're thrown into this circumstance where, you know, there's these two opposing political factions. Bob Marley's kind of looking to unite Jamaica again amidst all this conflict. But you're not really given any context on what either side stands for and what the main problems are. So that was something I felt a bit like I didn't really get a handle on it. And then it leaps through certain things very, very quickly. So, you know, like we move on very quickly from this assassination attempt. I felt like I was just never really getting the context that I needed. And then you've also, at the middle, you've got Kingsley Benadire as Bob Marley, who, again, he's an actor I've enjoyed in various things over the years. I think he's kind of a talented actor. But to me, he wasn't right for this film. There was just something felt really Hollywood about it. And again, I don't know how much sort of input the family and the estate had, but it felt like a really Hollywoodized version of Bob Marley to me. It just didn't feel like the Bob Marley I was familiar with from kind of the music, the albums, the sort of concert footage I've seen over the years. So that was another sort of distraction point for me. And then again, its final kind of big problem for me was that I didn't even think it really lent into the music in the way that the best of these do. And when you get those really great moments of people kind of either performing or building a song, that is one of the advantages of going down the authorized biography route, obviously, that when you get to use the songs, you've literally just got that ready-made exciting thing to throw into the film that people enjoy, and that you can lean on that sort of warm feelings and nostalgia and just the pure excitement of a great song. I never thought any of the musical scenes really capture that. There's one scene, one really brief scene, where we see Bob Marley and the Wailers when they're sort of much younger and they're going into one of their first sort of recording sessions, and they just start performing, and that had such energy to it. I just wish there was more like that. That was one of the few moments in the film I felt sort of galvanized and excited by it. Otherwise, yeah, I just didn't really connect with it at all, to be honest. And came away quite disappointed.
Yeah, I haven't seen this one yet. This is the one this week that has kind of got away from me, as it were. But yeah, I must say, I'm not sure I really want to see it after that roundup. That what about his wife, like Lashana Lynch, how is she in it? Because she's a good actor.
Again, yeah, very good actor. And she's not in it a great deal, to be honest, because of the way the story jumps about. And then again, similar to what we were saying about Madame Web, in a way that you do almost sense that maybe there was like, I mean, this is always the case, because obviously films always shoot more footage than they need, obviously. But there's a sense that there's like a longer film there, because it's not really the longest film, to be honest, as far as kind of biopics go. It's under 2 hours, I believe. And you know, like we kind of say, you're not spending a huge amount of time with her. And then there's this one good scene with her quite late on, where she kind of explodes at him and talks a bit about, you know, his infidelities and sort of hints at like raising these children that he's had with other women, as well as the sort of children they have themselves. And it's one of those things. It's a really small glimpse of something, and you're like, oh, that's interesting. I kind of wish it just would dig a bit more into that. But then, no, it's just on it goes. And again, another actor who's very poorly served here is James Norton, who, again, is obviously like a great actor, particularly, you know, Happy Valley. He's obviously
he's great,
kind of standout role today. But it's just got this really, really sort of lame role as this sort of record producer who just pops up to just deliver exposition every now and then. And I genuinely was like baffled as to why he did it. And I thought it must just be that he's a massive Bob Marley fan and wanted that kind of involvement. I'd have to guess, because it's just not worthy of, like, you know, what we know he's capable of.
The strange thing is, like, I haven't seen it, like I said, but if what you say is true, that it's really kind of Hollywoodized and sanitized, I don't think Bob Marley would want that. You know, from what I know of Bob Marley and his music, he was always, you know, someone who stood up and he was strong and he was sort of man of the people and against the system and all of that. So I don't think he'd want everything tamed down. Surely he'd want something a bit spiky.
I mean, you get that impression of him in the film, and it's not like it completely sat. Like, I mean, it does mention that, like, so those infidelities and things are mentioned, but just doesn't sort of dig into them as much as you would like. But, and one way as well, in which it doesn't go down the Hollywood route, which it might have done, or especially might have done in another time. It really leans into the sort of the patois and, like, the way he spoke, and they don't sort of hold back on that at all. So that's sort of a way that, where they really commit to it, you know, in a way that you could imagine it, them just really softening that for a mainstream US audience or whatever. Other than that, I did think it was a strangely sanitized, hard to get your head around what's exactly going on. Found it disappointing, I must say.
But the good news for everyone is that we've started off with two movies we've been very sort of down on, but stick around because things do get better.
Okay, so that was Bob Marley, One Love, which is also out now, if you do fancy seeing that. And now on to something a little tastier.
Nous passons plus de temps ensemble que bien des époux.
Je vous le demande encore, Marion.
Combien de fois encore allez-vous me poser cette question?
So that was The Taste of Things. Jamie, could you set this one up for us, please?
Well, there's not much to set up in terms of plot, but it's set in the 1880s in a kind of French chateau. And it's just two people, really, or mainly two people. It's Dodin, who is a great gourmet, who's played by Benoît Magimel. And it is Eugénie, played by Juliette Binoche, who is his cook, who's been working with him for 20 years. And she's kind of his cook and his muse, and every now and then his lover. Totally on her terms. When she wants to leave her bedroom door open, she does. When she doesn't, she shuts him out, and he kind of accepts that. He's very much in love with her. Every now and then he kind of proposes to her and she gently pushes him back. She's very happy with the relationship as it is. It is mainly about their great culinary skills that, you know, long stretches of this film is preparing food, like incredible food, and it's constantly stoves sizzling and reducing sauces. And it's one of those great food movies which come along, you know, something like Big Night, they come along every now and then, where Babette's Feast, where you just watch in awe and you're kind of, make sure you eat or have a very big bucket of popcorn when you go in to watch this, because it just gets the saliva going. Like, the food is wonderful. You know, there's a scene at one point in the film, which is 15 minutes with no dialogue, just like tracking them around the kitchen as they prepare the food. And it's all so elegantly done. It's just beautiful and mesmerizing. And it's sun-dappled kitchen, and you can hear the bird song outside. It really kind of takes you off to another place. I mean, if you want your cinema action-packed and plot-driven, it won't be for you. But if you're about tone and about mood and characters, then it is absolutely wonderful. Like, these two great actors who were actually married at one point in real life, like 1998 to 2003, and they have a child together. You know, they're so wonderful together. And just being with them and watching them interact is a great pleasure. Yeah, the love story really works. It's a really wonderful love story, even though it's sort of not low in the mix, but it's done with great subtlety. You know, it's not kind of in your face at all. And I can't recommend this film highly enough. You know, I don't know if I'm doing it justice with just how great it is that I may have made it sound a bit boring, but it's really not. It is fantastic. And it was the film that France put forward as their best international feature at the Oscars, which caused a real stir because obviously Anatomy of a Fall from France has been winning awards left, right and centre. And everyone was like, why have you put this forward instead of Anatomy of a Fall? And then it didn't get shortlisted. It's not in the five films that have been shortlisted as best international feature. But I have to say, you know, it's very different to Anatomy of a Fall, but it's every bit as great, if not greater, in my opinion. I can totally see why France put this forward, and I think it's ridiculous that it hasn't been shortlisted. Even in a strong year, the five films that have been listed are very strong, but this film is wonderful. You know, for me, it's a hands-down five-star.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I thought it was just great, mesmerizing.
I really like the sound of that, so I'll definitely be checking that out. And that was The Taste of Things, which is in cinemas now as well. They brought out a lot of films in time for Valentine's Day this week, so that's why a lot of these are already out now. And now on to our last new release of the week. It's a film with a lot of promise. So that was The Promised Land. Jamie, I haven't seen this one either. Could you set this one up for us, please?
So this is essentially a Nordic Western, and it's by Nikolai Arcel, who went to Hollywood. He did A Royal Affair, which got really good reviews and is a good film in Denmark. And then he went to Hollywood to make The Dark Tower, which, of course, was a bit of a disaster, a Stephen King adaptation. So he's gone back to his homeland and he's made this Nordic Western starring Mads Mikkelsen. And it's really, really good. I mean, the title in Danish is The Bastard, which actually sort of suggests to you that it's quite a tough film in some ways. And it's set in 1755. It's about Ludwig Kahlen, who's a retired captain, played by Mads Mikkelsen. And he's going off to this wild heathland to try and tame it. He's going to build a home there and he wants to grow a crop of potatoes. And the king really wants people to go to this place, and he wants people to sort of domesticate and tame the land and sort of, you know, get produce there. But no one can do it. Everyone who's tried has failed dismally. But, you know, the land is just awful and tough, and the weather is so harsh, and people have gone back with their tail between their legs. But this captain, played by Mads, is a really strong character, as you can imagine, and he goes there and he succeeds, and he's growing potatoes. You know, not since Matt Damon grew potatoes on Mars have we seen someone succeed under such extraordinary circumstances with growing potatoes. And he's doing really well, but then there's a local landowner, Frederik de Schinkel, who's played by Simon Benajerg, and he believes that this captain is trespassing on his land, even though the king wants him to be there. This local landowner is, no, it's my land. So he's determined that this captain should fail. And this guy, this landowner, is such a great villain. It's hard to explain because in a way he's a real sort of boo hiss evil pantomime villain, that he is so nasty and so vicious and cruel, and it's really fun to hate him. But at the same time, somehow it's not a pantomime villain, that what he does is so horrendous. And some of the film is so cruel. And because you've got this atmosphere where it's really earthy and it's windy and it feels real, but it also really affects you. It's not just like a sort of heightened camp version of a villain, that, you know, he does stuff where you will literally wince and hate him and he's appalling. But to see these two guys kind of lock horns, these two actors really go at it and have this battle of wills. It's really good. You know, it's a really good Nordic Western. We should just say as well, I know you're just wrapping that up, but we should say as well that it's not just all, you know, I've talked about the two guys that makes it sound very male and macho, but there's a couple of great female characters in it as well. And there's also this little Roma girl who becomes like a surrogate daughter to Mads Mikkelsen's character. You know, at first he rejects her, then he has to take her in. And through this character who in 1755, you know, Denmark, there's very, very few people of colour. So you can imagine the kind of racist abuse that is hurled at this little girl, and Mads sort of stands up to it. So through this character, you know, it's a really sort of good look at racial tensions. And there's a lot about class and status in it as well, you know, trying to go up in the world and people looking down at you. So there's a lot in there. You know, I do recommend it.
Well, again, that also sounds intriguing. I feel like I've perhaps made the wrong choices on the two films I watched this week. But I'll definitely check that out because I was, I'm obviously a big fan of Mads Mikkelsen. I really liked A Royal Affair. And I also note that this is co-written by Anders Thomas Jensen, who's worked with Mads several times, most recently on Riders of Justice, which I absolutely love that film. I thought that was a little underseen gem of a couple of years ago. So, so I'll definitely be checking this out. So that is The Promised Land, which is the only one that isn't out yet. That's in cinemas from Friday, the 16th of February. And also, before we go, we wanted just to quickly mention there are a few films being re-released this week. So if we've put you off the sound of some of the new releases. So you've got Interview with the Vampire is back for its 30th anniversary. Les Miserables, the Tom Hooper musical starring Hugh Jackman, is back for some reason. And One from the Heart, Reprise by Francis Ford Coppola, that's out as well. Jamie, are you excited about these films being back in the cinema?
I mean, Interview with a Vampire, it's a good, I don't think it's, you know, it's not in my top 10 vampire films, but it's definitely worth seeing for like the production design, the cinematography. It's so kind of sumptuous. And then you've got Tom Cruise playing Lestat, who's this kind of very seductive, charismatic, but dark villain. And I can remember when he was cast, because I'm old enough to remember this back in the early 90s, but when he was cast, Anne Rice, the author of the novels, was very anti Tom Cruise playing Lestat because he's blonde and, you know, he's sort of quite a homoerotic relationship, and you can't really see Cruise playing it, the Cruise of Top Gun and stuff. You know, it's like, why have they cast this Hollywood star? But he proved everyone wrong and he got rave reviews for it. And to this day, I think it's one of his most interesting performances. And like him and Brad Pitt, you know, it's really sort of sensual, good relationship. And then there's a young Kirsten Dunst playing this 10-year-old vampire who's kind of frozen to be 10 years old through time. And it was a role that sort of announced her to the world, and she was fantastic in it. So that's definitely worth seeing again at the cinema. One from the Heart, the Coppola 1981 musical, is kind of a mixed bag, that it's technically very audacious, and, you know, he recreated this kind of surreal version of Las Vegas on a sound stage. You know, this is coming after Apocalypse Now, so you can imagine the sort of scale. He always pushes things, and he invented new technology for this film. And he's trying to do a sort of old-fashioned musical, but jamming it up against sort of modernity, that the characters in the film have very sort of real relationship problems, and they go off and have affairs and stuff. And it sort of has that banality juxtaposed with the kind of romantic fantasy and the scale. And it's an interesting film, but it doesn't really work. You know, I think it's a minor Coppola film. He's gone back to it several times over the intervening years and twiddled with it, like, you know, George Lucas does. And this version has 6 extra minutes to what we've seen before. But I think it's a film that's interesting, maybe worth seeing on a cinema screen for the spectacle and the ambition. But it's definitely not The Godfather or Apocalypse Now. You know, it's several rungs below that. And then the final film you mentioned being re-released, Les Miserables, is a film I never want to see again.
Really?
Not because I hated it. I actually thought it was okay, you know, and I quite enjoyed it. But I can remember after seeing it when it first came out, I saw the press screening and I was earwormed like I've never been earwormed before for about 2 months. And it's not even a case of loving the songs. It's one thing being earwormed when you sort of tap along to a song, but it was songs I didn't particularly like. But from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to bed, I was humming them and tapping them, and it drove me absolutely mad to the point I wanted to go and see the doctor and see if I could do something to get these songs out my head. So I haven't gone back to rewatch that one, and I doubt I ever will.
Yeah, I had a weird experience with Les Miserables, because when I saw it in the cinema, I absolutely loved it. And I thought it kind of verged on like being a 5-star. And then I watched it again at home, sort of when it came out on DVD, and just really, really lost something massively on that second viewing. And I was like, oh, it just really felt like just a kind of a 3-star that I couldn't really care that much about. And so I just don't know if it was just due to the big picture and the big sound being needed for that sort of film. And I was kind of impressed by the sort of live singing aspect as well the first time, which again, maybe that lost some of the thrill of the new when I rewatched it. But it's one of those films that really sticks in my mind that changed a lot on those viewings. I say, just loved it that first time and then just felt a bit underwhelmed. So maybe it's worth me trying to catch it again while it's on the big screen.
Anne Hathaway won her Oscar for it, didn't she?
Yes.
Best Supporting Actress. I remember her being impressive in it. Russell Crowe's voice, maybe not quite so impressive. Kind of vague memories. I think I've tried to push that film out my mind because I was earwormed so bad. I don't want it anywhere near my brain pan anymore.
There's quite a few options this week. And I just wanted to add quickly, because we are going to take a 1-week break next week. So we won't be here next week, but we'll be back in full force the week after that in time for June part 2. Next week, there's a film coming out called Wicked Little Letters, which, again, as far as new releases go, that to me, I would say is worth a watch. To sum up very simply, you've got this. It's based on a true story. So we're in kind of 20s England in a seaside town, and a woman called Edith Swan, who's played by Olivia Colman, she's kind of still lives with her parents, and she starts receiving these really foul-mouthed letters of abuse. And then the sort of prime suspect for that is Rose Gooding, who's played by Jessie Buckley. And she's kind of the Irish neighbour who's very recently moved in next door. So because she's very sweary, she's kind of the prime suspect. It basically escalates from there, and it's a kind of a bit of a mystery as to where these letters are actually coming from. And who's really behind it. I saw this at the Toronto Film Festival last year. Sometimes when you're at a film festival like that, you just really need a light-hearted, you know, feel-good mainstream kind of film just to hit the spot in amidst all the kind of heavier sort of festival fare you get. And this, to me, just really delivered when I just needed something fun. It's, yeah, just obviously those two absolutely great actors leading it. You've got the next supporting role is this police officer, Gladys Moss, who's played by Anjana Vasan. She was very likable as well.
She was, and yeah.
It's just very funny. It's very sweary. Olivia Colman and Jessie Buckley kind of doing what they do best in a way. This is like another Wild Rose for Jessie Buckley. And, you know, Olivia Colman just kind of great in anything she touches really as well. And it's one of those films that it's not like, I wouldn't say it's one of the all-time greats. It's not going to rank on like the sort of finest films of the year by the time we get to the end of the year. But just really kind of satisfyingly enjoyable and fun. And when I went to see Madame Web, you know, at the cinema last night, they played the trailer for this and it seemed to actually go down really well with the audience.
Yeah.
So I reckon it could potentially be a little sort of Brit hit, perhaps. The sort of film you could enjoy watching like with your parents or whatever. I mean, obviously there's the foul language, but it's delivered in a sort of fun way. And it's just an enjoyable little story.
I saw the trailer last night as well before Madame Web, and I've seen the movie a few weeks ago or a couple of months ago. And again, it went down well. And just a moment like Jessie Buckley and Olivia Colman popped up in the trailer and they're sort of going head to head, you know, it makes you grin. And I think the film is maybe not quite as wicked as it could have been, you know, Wicked Little Letters. That it's, you know, it could have been a little bit darker and a little bit sort of spikier. But I did really enjoy it. And I think those two actors are great. And, you know, Jessie Buckley, I just think is absolutely tremendous. Everything she's in, I just absolutely adore. The moment she comes on screen, I just really enjoy her company. So I'd say it's definitely worth seeing for those two who are friends in real life and sort of lock horns on screen.
Yeah. So if you fancy that, that's Wicked Little Letters. And that's out next week on Friday, the 23rd of February. So, Jamie, we've just got time for the last couple of bits. What would be your film of the week this week?
My film of the week, without any doubt would be the taste of things that I think Promised Land is definitely worth a watch as well. You know, Promised Land is a strong 4-star movie, but for me, Taste of Things is really quite special. And I think it would be close to my top 10 list at the end of the year.
I don't feel like I can really pick a film of the week this week because obviously I haven't seen those latter two films, which actually sounded quite good, but just wouldn't be right to call Madam Web or Bob Marley One Love my film of the week.
Go for one of the re-releases, Matt. Interview with a Vampire.
Yeah, or maybe I'd even go for Wicked Little Letters if we're sort of grouping that into, broadly speaking, this week of the podcast. A bit of a poor week for me, really. But there you go. This happens. This is all part of the life of a film fan. You know, you've got to expect disappointments every now and then.
Rough with the smooth.
And so basically that just leaves us to really say, if you enjoy this podcast, we would love it if you could subscribe and rate it on your podcast app of choice. It means you'll never miss an episode and it helps others to find us. And remember, you can always contact us on our social media channels or email us at totalfilm@futurenet.com. Just before we go, we've just got time for one quick question, which is, what is your favourite directorial debut?
Okay, in time-honoured Jamie tradition, I can't answer this simply. I actually went away. I love this question. I love making lists. I love stuff like this. I made a list of my top 50, and it was hard to get it down to 50. It's amazing how many tremendous debuts there's been over the years, but I'm going to give a quick sort of 4 or 5 runners-up, and then I'll hit you with my winner. So Badlands, Terrence Malick, Night of the Living Dead, George Romero, Eraserhead, David Lynch, The Blair Witch Project, 400 Blows, Truffaut, Blood Simple, Coen Brothers, Bird with the Crystal Plumage, Dario Argento. They're all movies I love. If I was going to highlight one from recent years, After Sun by Charlotte Wells, I absolutely adore it. Haunts me to this day. But of all time, and in a way, it's a really boring choice, the film critic choice, but it's Citizen Kane for me, because it just changed cinema, and it's such a grandstanding achievement as a character study, trying to get to the core of a kind of contradictory man. And then through its technical pyrotechnics, you know, the fireworks. And people, if you're out there and you haven't seen Citizen Kane, and maybe you haven't because you've been put off because it's always high in the sight and sound list and it sounds dusty and boring, 1941, blah, 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 I urge you to see it, because the reason I love this film is it's still to this day so inventive and thrilling and dazzling. And I watch it like once a year and it always blows me away. So Citizen Kane.
Yeah, you absolutely shouldn't be put off by it if you are, because I can fully understand why you might be, like you say, but it's just, yeah, it's just such an enjoyable film to watch now, even, you know, that it's not at all like a sort of homework film if you feel like it could be that way. The thing is, you've pretty much covered that very comprehensively. The only one I'm just going to throw in, just because it's just the most obvious one that always comes to my mind when talking about debuts, but would be Reservoir Dogs.
Yes.
Just because in terms of thinking of like a debut as like a calling card, that always just pops into my head when thinking about debuts. But like you mentioned, there's so many great ones. And then I was going to shout out one of a recent year as well, which would be St. Maud by Rose Glass. That was just another one where you sort of see the film and you're just like, wow, this is an exciting new talent. You do get debuts a lot of the time. You might say, oh, it feels like a debut, you know, it feels a bit unsure perhaps, or it feels like it's got promise, but it's not sort of fully there. But that was one of those that came out fully formed and you're like, wow, you know, who is this and what are they going to do next?
I actually went on a college reunion a couple of weeks ago. I went back to where I went to university, and they've kind of updated the cinema, but it's still where it was. It's the same cinema. They've just sort of put in new screens. And when we walked past it, my best mate, Bilge, that's his nickname, Paul Freshwater, but Bilge, he actually stopped and pointed at the pavement and he said, do you remember when me and you in 1991, that's the year I went to uni, saw Reservoir Dogs there, and we stood outside on this bit of pavement afterwards and we were both literally shaking and thrilled and just couldn't stop talking. We were like, it's like, you know, we'd eaten 500 chocolate bars, we were just buzzing. And very few films have impacted like that. You know, it may be hard to believe now all these years later and so many people have copied it, but there was nothing like it then, and I'll never forget the reaction I had to that movie. So that is a great choice.
Awesome. And so, yeah, that's it from us this week, but we'll see you back in 2 weeks' time. Bye.
Bye.
this morning.